This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For decades now, Cornel West has been a leading voice on politics, religion, race, and culture. He's a teacher at Princeton and Harvard, in prisons and churches, an author whose books include bestsellers like Race Matters and Democracy Matters, and a performer. Maybe you saw him as Counselor West in two Matrix movies. Today we'll speak to him as Brother West about his new memoir called Living and Loving Out Loud, where he describes himself as a blues man in the life of the mind and a jazz man in the world of ideas. We'll talk to him about what that means and ask him about his family, his thinking, and his many passions. If you'd like to speak with Cornel West about the people and forces that shaped his life, the many controversies he's been involved in, or about the role he hopes to play as Frederick Douglass to Barack Obama's Abraham Lincoln, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And joining us now from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, our member station there, Cornel West. He's class of 1943 university professor in the Center for African American Studies at Princeton. And with David Ritz, he wrote Living and Loving Out Loud. Nice to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's always a blessing, my dear brother.
By writing a memoir, I wonder, are you, in a sense, holding up your life for examination and offering your story as a kind of model?
Well, I'd say not so much a model, but maybe to provide an insight here or there to help somebody come to terms with the dark corners of their own soul, to come to terms with the underside of their own sense of self, and maybe to help develop a capacity to love wisdom.
Yet you seem to be have been, justice. You seem to have been from a very early age a very self-possessed person.
Well, I was blessed with tremendous passion, tremendous energy, tremendous enthusiasm. As you know, early on, I had to find the right channel because I was a gangster when I was young. I had a Robin Hood mentality and tended to always want to support the weak against the strong, but sometimes it was coercive, and I really needed the power of love and the power of education to find the right venue, the best venue to express my rage. I still have a righteous indignation at injustice, no matter what form it takes. It could be homophobia, it could be white supremacy, male supremacy, imperial arrogance, class subordination, or whatever. So the rage is still there, but I found the right kind of channel because it's tied to a love, it's tied to a struggle for justice, and most importantly for me, it's tied to a recognition that I am a crack vessel.
There are any numbers of tests that all of us as children go through. You describe one. There's a bridge that you needed to cross, a rickety old bridge you needed to cross. So I guess all the black kids in your town needed to cross to get on their way to school, and it was only wide enough for one car, and if you were walking on the bridge when a car was there, you were in big trouble.
No, that's very true. You know, on that chocolate side of town in my blessed city, Sacramento, California, that was the beginning of my death shudders, oh brother. That's why Kierkegaard and Kafka began to make sense to me when I was very, very young. That radical sense of the fragility of life and the inevitability of death, those trucks coming. If the truck came at the same time I was on the bridge, I was in the creek. My body would be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms. So that early on, you had to have this sense of, do I have the courage? Am I brave enough to walk across that bridge every day when I went to kindergarten?
And one of the things that drew you across the bridge was the fact that a really pretty girl lived on the other side.
Yeah, old Sister Dolores. I remember listening to the great Curtis Mayfield's Gypsy Woman from nowhere through a caravan around the campfire lights. I mean, I tell you, that song meant much to me. And Dolores meant much. And, of course, I never got a chance to even talk to the sister. It was like Just My Imagination by Eddie Kendricks and the Temptations. It was a projection. It was a fantasy. But fantasies are real. They have effects on your soul, even though I was too young to really step forward.
There is so much of your life that you describe in terms of the music that you were listening to at the time, and the way it moved you, the way it propelled you, and yes, it's the rock and roll and the R&B of your youth, but it's also other kinds of music, too.
Well, all kinds. I mean, beginning with Stephen Sondheim, I couldn't live without the genius of Stephen Sondheim, be it not just West Side Story, but Follies Company, Sweeney Todd, Passion, You can go on and on.
I assume you know that there's a revival of A Little Night Music. It's going to open in New York in a couple of weeks.
Yes, and Send In The Clowns. I can't wait with Desiree. Send In The Clowns. I know they don't sound like Sarah Vaughan when she sings it, but the song itself, it's such a majestic, powerful, and, of course, comedic in its own way. But, I mean, most importantly for me, you know, growing up, it was the spirituals, it was the gospels, it was James Cleveland, Aretha Franklin, Marianne Williams, and then it was Curtis Mayfield, mm-hmm. The Main Ingredients, The Whispers, Black Blue Magic, James Brown, Aretha Franklin, Luther Vandross. That music helped me preserve my sanity, helped me preserve whatever dignity I was able to preserve, helped me to keep going. It was a source of tremendous strength in my life. That's why, for me, music is in no way ornamental or decorative. It's constitutive of who I am. And that's why when I say I'm a blues man, that's a very serious vocation. To muster the courage to find your own unique voice, to forge your distinctive style in the world, to leave your imprint in the sands of time in such a way that your singularity, your individuality remains something that people have to come to terms with. That's B.B. King, that's Ma Rainey, that's Bessie Smith, that's Leroy Carr, that's Bruce Springsteen, that's Bob Dylan, that's Janet Joplin, and that's even Daryl Halls, my dear, dear brother, blues man too.
There are other aspects of being a blues man, though. Among them, you got to keep moving.
You got to keep moving. That's the difficulty, though, brother, because you know, sooner or later, you do get tired. You know, we're all vanishing organisms and disappearing creatures in space and time. That death sentence in space and time that Kafka talked about with such profundity. And so the question becomes, what do you do in the meantime? And you are, if you're ever forever on the move, especially in the life of the mind, forever reading voraciously, writing, speaking, lecturing, trying to unsettle minds, trying to touch souls, trying to encourage and inspire on the one hand, but also trying to unhouse and unnerve people so that they have to reexamine themselves, society, and the world on the others. There's tremendous joy in it. I've been blessed, I think, to have tremendous joy in my life in pursuing my vocation, my calling. And yet, as you know from the story, there's an underside to that, too. You know, I had blackouts, falling out, of course, the death threats of people showing up and putting guns to my wife's head with a mask, and people having shotguns in the driveway looking for me or announcing that I've already died before lectures and sending it through newspaper, sending it to newspaper columnists and my mother and so on. There's a real night side to my particular calling, which is to try to bear witness to love and truth.
We're talking with Cornel West. The latest book of his many is called Living and Loving Out Loud. He's with us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's start with Emmanuel. Emmanuel with us from Concord in California.
Good morning. Dr. West, it's an honor and a pleasure to speak with you.
I've honor to speak with you, my dear brother.
Okay, thank you. I've heard you address the topic of rap and hip-hop on a number of occasions, and I was wondering if you acknowledge a distinction between the two art forms, rap and hip-hop.
Well, I appreciate it. No, rap is just a moment within the larger culture of hip-hop. Karius, one, and others, as you know, have theorized this in such a way that hip-hop embraces a variety of different activities. Rap is a moment in. You got graffiti and a host of other moments as well. But the important thing for me as an educator is how do we unsettle the minds and touch the souls of significant numbers of young people who don't read text or don't read my text. And that's why I've made three CDs. It's spoken word, but I have a number of hip-hop artists. Talib Kweli's on there. KRS-One is on there. M1 is there. Rod Digger is there. Jill Scott is there. Prince, of course, collaborating with the musical genius of our time in some ways, with Prince himself, the late great Gerald Levert. All these are forms of singing education, and what the Greeks call paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A, that deep education to get us to shift from superficial things to serious things, to shift from bling bling to life and death and justice and pain and joy, those fundamental elemental things that we must come to terms with as we make our moves from our mother's womb to the tomb. And I think hip-hop can be prophetic and progressive, but at the same time, the dominant forms tend to be homophobic, misogynistic, and something that we need to critically call into question.
That's why I actually called. I kind of been with you. all those positive aspects, those artists you name, I consider those hip hop artists. And those with the negativity, with no poetry involved, no substance involved, I consider that. Right?
Oh, I see. So yeah, you've got your own definition, different than Brother KRS One and the others. In a certain sense, we're concerned about the same issues. How do you accent the progressive, the prophetic, those things that are critical of all forms of injustice, all forms of bigotry, all forms of dehumanizing other people, and yet still allow for a certain kind of flow, linguistic flow, certain kinds of melodies and harmonies in the samplings to take place? But I think KRS-One in some ways has laid out the real framework, because there's a number of hip-hop artists who are highly talented but politically retrograde.
Emmanuel,
this has been true for any art form. Look at Celine's novel, you know, anti-Semitic, almost pro-Nazi, and yet it has a lyricism at the same time. What are you going to do with Celine's novel?
Birth of a Nation, a pretty good movie, unfortunately, but a pretty good movie.
Well, technologically and so forth, you know, it's a breakthrough, and yet, you know, very white supremacist to the core in terms of the narrative content. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Emmanuel, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, man.
Can you tell us, we just have a few seconds left before we have to go to a break, but what are you doing in Georgia?
Oh, no, I'm down here. I was just on the Monique show. I had a chance to choose one artist. I chose George Clinton, and we just taped the show. I spoke at Emory last night. I've been on radio and TV. I'm speaking tonight at a church, so I'm in ATL on tour and loving it, because I do love Atlanta, Georgia.
We're talking with Cornel West more in just a moment on music, philosophy, and, well, what he's wearing today. His memoir is called Loving Out Loud. We're taking your questions at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Type Cornel West into Google, IMDb, or Amazon. You'll begin to get a sense of his range. He's a much lauded public intellectual and actor in the Matrix movies. He's released a spoken word and rap album, not to mention 20 books now. We're talking about his latest. It's a memoir. If you'd like to read an excerpt in which Cornel West discusses great blues artists from Marvin Gaye and B.B. King to Toni Morrison and Bruce Springsteen and his own journey as a blues man moving through America, you can go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. If you'd like to speak with Cornel West about the people, forces, blues men and women that shaped his love, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And as our listeners have figured out, Cornel West, this is radio. You're in Atlanta. I can't see you. But because I believe it's such a part of you, I know what you're wearing, a three-piece black suit, a white shirt, black tie. What does that outfit mean to you?
Oh, you're absolutely right. Well, I was deeply influenced by the sartorial practices of both preachers and jazz musicians, and actually Marsha in Act One of Anton Chekhov, my favorite writer's masterpiece, Three Sisters, when she arrives reflecting on whether they're ever going to get to Moscow, memories of the death of their father, and she's in black, and she says, I'm in mourning for the world, saying in part that I have a sad soul and a cheerful disposition. I can be up, but I know deep down I'm still trying to come to terms with the suffering, not only of myself, not only of my loved ones, but all of those around the world.
There's a comment you quote in the book. Somebody say you also look like a funeral director.
Well, that's true in a certain sense, because all of us living on the edge, you know, death is always a constant possibility.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Probability, and of course an inevitability as well. But I was so glad to hear you playing John Coltrane, The Love Supreme.
Oh, that wasn't me. That was Gwen, our director, Gwen Newton.
Was? Yeah. Oh, that hit me so hard, my brother Neil. You know the chapter I have on Train in the book?
I do indeed.
He changed my life. how rare it is that he's a spiritual saint and an artistic genius at the same time, but he knows that a saint is nothing but a sinner who looks at the world through the lens of the heart and therefore has a hypersensitivity to the suffering of others. And then as an artistic genius, he has a mastery of his craft, a mastery of technique, but he uses it in such an unpredictable way, a creative way. He takes risks. It's a rare combination. Dead at 40 years old. He's the same age as Franz Kafka, 40 years old.
Let's get another caller in on the line. This is Chalandra. Chalandra with us in Birmingham.
Hi, Dr. West. This is Shalonda Capers. I attended your speech yesterday at Emory. My question is not so much about your memoir, which I read and love, but from your book, Hope on a Tightrope. You made a statement about women being the next wave of leadership. I just wanted you to kind of expound on that a little bit more, about what you meant and what does that look like to you, that new wave of leadership being led by women.
I just think that as the ugly forms of patriarchy begin to fade or be pushed back, there's still some subtle forms actually operating in a variety of different ways. But as the ugly forms of patriarchy are pushed back, I think the next wave, especially of high-quality leadership, will be disproportionately women. I think there's a real sense in which the kind of male-centered, ego-oriented, status-obsessed forms of leadership are simply just running out of gas. Hmm. People want something real. They want somebody who's got an honesty, a candor, someone who is willing to take a risk and step out and tell the truth. And I do believe that the decline of patriarchy provides that possibility. Now, of course, the women can always choose the patriarchal models when you end up with a Margaret Thatcher.
Interesting. I wonder, Chalandra, you read the book. There's a passage in which Cornel West is talking about the breakup of a personal relationship and said he had to go his way to pursue his calling, which was teaching and dialoguing with dozens of people whose minds nurtured my own. And then you write the line, Cornel West, women want and deserve inordinate attention. What do you mean by that?
You can't have a high-quality relationship without time and without trust. Now, I'm pretty good on the trust, but my time is always so tight because I'm on the move all the time. It is very difficult to sustain a high-quality relationship that has the kind of mutual intensity, it has the kind of mutual respect without putting in time. Now, of course, I could have said it the other way. The men also require an ordered attention in terms of a high-quality relationship because the standards apply to brothers as well as sisters as well as brothers of all colors, all cultures, all civilizations. But you have to have that time. And I think B.B. King and James Brown and Aretha and the others will tell you that it's hard to sustain high-quality relationships when you're a blues man or woman.
Hmm. Chalandra, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Chalandra.
Let's see if we go next to Tom. Tom calling us from San Lorenzo in California.
Hello?
You're on the air, Tom. Go ahead, please.
All right, my brother. I am so happy to hear you. I mean, just hear your voice. I think you are the articulation of my soul, man. It's every word you speak, I mean, it's like I'm living it.
Very kind, my dear brother, Tom.
Yes, I love you. But listen, I'd like to ask you a question. I know you've been a vocal proponent for sexual minorities, mainly homosexuals, and that's fine. But I was wondering, how do you feel about people who are transgender? Do you offer the same level of support for them?
Oh, absolutely, though, brother. I mean, I love my gay brothers. I love my lesbian sisters. I love my transvestite, my gender-bending folk. For me, it's a matter of embracing their humanity, allowing them to choose in such a way that they are in the driver's seat regarding their lives. And of course, there's always effects and consequences, tremendous challenges, especially in a homophobic society. But I don't draw any distinctions between forms of bigotry or forms of ideology that lose sight of the humanity of people. I can't stand white supremacy. I can't stand male supremacy. I can't stand imperial subjugation. I can't stand homophobia. I can't stand anti-Jewish hatred. I can't stand anti-Arab hatred. All of those, to me, have to be radically called into question. And if I'm the last brother who's saying that, then I'll be the last brother saying it, because that's what I believe, you know?
And I'm right with you. I want to ask you one more question. how do you perceive the black community's perception of those topics, homosexuality and transgenderism? And I'm done. I'll listen to you after.
All right, Tom, thanks very much. Just put that in the context of Proposition 8, in which the black churches in California were perceived as playing a very important role in the defeat of Proposition 8. Or the passage of Proposition 8, excuse me.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's too many. It wasn't just black churches. Too many black folk in general played a regressive role tied to the Mormon brothers and sisters who actually provided certain financial undergirding for that campaign against my gay brothers and lesbian sisters. But it's just a matter of being honest and candid and acknowledging homophobia cuts very deep in the culture across the board. I don't care what color the culture. I don't care what slice or part of the country. Homophobia is very, very difficult to root out, to extricate. That's why we have to bear witness. That's why we have to be so public about it. And that's why we can't just play footsie with it. It's one part of my critique, even in the Obama administration in this regard. You have to explicitly call it out for what it is, in the same way other forms of bigotry had to be called out in the history of this nation, the male supremacy and the white supremacy and so on. But it's difficult. And so in the black community, okay, we have discussions in the church. Well, the Bible says gay, active, lesbian. Well, what did Jesus say? Not a mumbling word. Well, it was so important, how come he didn't say anything? Well, Paul did, yeah, but Paul said, slaves, be obedient to your masters. We got around that one. A lot of hermeneutical tap dancing in order to get around that one. Well, Paul said, women, be quiet in church. Well, I'm Black Baptist in origin, right? So we didn't. Mm-hmm. We got around that one quick in terms of the joyful noise we make in the name of the Lord. So that we have to be honest in terms of what do we mean by not just love thy neighbor, which is part of prophetic Judaism, Leviticus 19:18, but even love thy enemy. And by enemy, we're not talking about persons, but principalities, deeds that warrant a hatred, and yet you hate the deed even as you love the doer. So it looks like the doer is an enemy, but you still love the doer. That's what Martin King meant when he said he loves Bull O'Connor. He's not sadomasochistic. He's not loving the white supremacy in Bull. He's loving the fact that Bull O'Connor was made in the image of God, who chose to be a cowardly white supremacist, even as he was a Sunday school teacher and oftentimes would condone the death of precious black brothers and sisters. That's the kind of spirit that for me is necessary. I don't think Christians have a monopoly on it. I think it's necessary for democracies to flower and flourish. And one of the reasons why democracy is in such crisis in the American empire is because we don't have enough courage in terms of cultivating that kind of spirit of struggle, of courage, of empathy, of imagination. That's why the poets are so crucial. That last line of Percy's In Defense of Poetry: poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And he wasn't just talking about versifiers. He was talking about all of those who have the courage to cultivate their empathy and their imagination and to provide alternatives to a cold and cruel world, to use the different bits of reality to create new realities. This is what Eudora Welty, one of the grand American Jacobean writers, would say. Same point. That's why I love the poets. And for me, musicians are poets. You know, Beethoven described himself as a poet of tones, just like Coltrane's A Poet of Temples.
Here's an email from Melissa. I'm reading your memoir and take inspiration from your drive for education. I live in Ithaca, and I feel there's a disconnect between the university, colleges, and the community. How do you suggest universities and colleges can reach out to their underserved communities?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I mean, one of the points I try to make in the memoir is the ways in which, you know, I worked on the breakfast program of the Black Panther Party, and I am a Jesus-loving free black man, so some of the secular sensibilities and even the atheisms of the Panther Party we had debates on, but I loved their love of the poor. They had a breakfast program. I worked with that 3 years. Same is true with the prison program. We need more town gown relations to consolidate and solidify so that the community feels as if they're part and parcel of the university. The university feels part and parcel of the community, but the university never loses sight of its distinctive function in the society, which is to courageously pursue true small t, knowledge small k, knowing that, of course, that quest for truth is perennial and endless. We never possess the truth, capital T, or possess knowledge, capital K. It's endless. But still, the university can have that kind of mission and embrace the community. And the community, of course, can learn so much from the university and teach the university some things, because the community is not simply about truth and knowledge. It's about a lot of love and taking care of the kids and nurturing the young ones and so on.
Living and Loving Out Loud, a memoir, is the latest of Cornel West's many books. He wrote it with David Ritz, and he's joining us today from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. Let's go to Kaba. Kaba, with us from Cleveland. I hope I'm pronouncing your name properly.
Yes, am I on the air?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Mr. West, I recently saw you with a picture next to Bashir Jones in Cleveland, and I was pretty impressed, and I've always had respect for you. My question is,
yes, how you
when I look at black-on-black crime in the black communities, and I see the trends in in Congo, places like this, where blacks are murdering other blacks and problems are happening. Have you ever, and also since we have the first black president, we do see some form of equality occurring in America. If there isn't a check on, I would say, the attitudes of some black people, do you think that it's possible to have black supremacy in America, just as there was white supremacy in America at one point in time? And if so, do you think it's a concern to address those sort of black-on-black crime issues or threat of black supremacy?
Well, I appreciate the question, though, brother. No, I don't think we have to worry about institutionalized forms of black supremacy at all. I mean, even dear brother Barack Obama, as the first black president in the history of the United States, that he recognizes, of course, that his team is not just multiracial and multicultural, but other than him, you don't have too many black folk and Negroes at the top anyway. So the real question is, how do we speak to the kind of black self-hatred and self-violation and black self-destruction? I'm concerned about white brothers and sisters killing other white brothers and sisters, too. There's a lot of white self-hatred, white self-destruction, white self-violation as well. A lot of it has to do with the generational neglect, which is to say the neglect of generation after generation of generation of people in poor communities, in hoods, families shattered, communities feeble. Guns available, bullets flying, drugs being sold or bought and sold, people feeling as if there's no way out other than using the guns to violate others or even kill and murder others. We see it with the precious brother Albert in Chicago, and we need to make it a priority. I really believe that the kind of violence in poor communities, it could be black, it can be white, it can be red, are issues of national security. In the same way the war in Afghanistan is an issue of national security, but it's hard to make it a priority in our society. And that's the real challenge, and that's why I don't think we have to worry about black supremacy at all, because black supremacy would be then a whole society organized around the notion that black people are better, more intelligent, more beautiful, more moral than white folk, and we don't have any evidence of that kind of regime emerging. It's certainly not in the Obama administration. Barack Obama, his real challenge is whether he's going to be a great statesman like Lincoln or another politician like Bill Clinton. And so far, he's leading toward the latter, but we shall see. He has a chance to be great. We've got to just put a lot of pressure on our dear brother. We've got to make sure he is protected. We have to make sure he's respected, but we have to make sure he is corrected when he's not leaning toward the weak and supporting the poor and supporting working people, as opposed to being tied into Wall Street investment bankers and the corporate oligarchs and plutocrats at the top who have been embezzling and sometimes just outright looting when it comes to just making money based on predatory lending, obsessed with profits that are so excessive in a nation in which 20% of its children live in poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. What kind of society are we? What kind of people are we given that kind of wealth inequality and greed running amok?
Kaba, thanks very much for the call. And we just have a minute left with you, Cornel West, but I did want to ask you, as you know, the president's in the middle of making a decision about policy in Afghanistan. If he called you in the same way that President Lincoln spoke with Frederick Douglass from time to time, what would you tell him?
I would tell him it'd be very difficult to have a peace prize and be a war president. I would say that Afghanistan has been the graveyard and the cemeteries of empires from Britain, the Soviet Union, and now the American Empire. Yes, maybe some NATO troops. Yes, maybe some collective activity. But this notion of sending precious and priceless young people to Afghanistan in the thousands and thousands and thousands, does not look promising. Think it over. I'm praying for you, President. I love you and your first family, but I'm first and foremost someone who tries to tell the truth. Blues Man in the Life of the Mind.
The book is Living and Loving Out Loud, a memoir, Cornel West, with David Ritz. And Cornel West, we're going to ask you to stay with us for a couple of minutes, if you would, because coming up,
absolutely,
singer-songwriter Carly Simon is with us. And what you may not know is that she and Cornel West have an interesting connection. He wrote about it in his book. We'll tell you about it in just a minute or two. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.